This episode of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast is brought to you by Harrys.com. Go to Harrys.com now and use offer code Duncan to get $5 off some sweet German-engineered razor blades that are going to make your face look like the president's bottom. Good day to you, my perfectly harmonized tapestry of breathing cells. It is I, Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast. And what a special day it is today. Not only is it 420, but it is also my birthday. And I'm not ashamed to announce it, though I do consider the concept of birthdays to ultimately be a ridiculous kind of bookmark that we place on the circuit of time that we're currently being sucked through. And mostly things that either invoke a sense of grief or terror, some combination of all of those, or shame. Some people are ashamed of whatever particular bookmark they've happened to reach in this particular incarnation for whatever reason. I certainly get age shame sometimes, like, my God, I'm so very old. It's a stupid cult. You know, it's just the feeling of shame that comes from being addicted to your age has got to be the punishment for worshiping a false god, which is the concept of time or the importance of years. You're going to figure it out. Either you've already figured it out if you're over a certain age, or you're going to figure it out if you're under a certain age, or maybe you've already figured it out just because you're super smart. But one thing you're going to realize is that time is an illusion, and that though you might gain some skill when it comes to manipulating the material universe around you that exceeds the skill of other people just because of the number of repetitions that you have practiced while playing whatever particular game it is that you happen to be playing, underneath it all, there seems to exist an unchanging spark of youth that always is going to feel young, and not just young, but is always going to feel outside of time. This is the thing in the Bhagavad Gita that Krishna talks about. It cannot be burnt by fire, weathered by the wind. It was never born, will never die. It never came into being, nor will it cease to be. They call it the Atman, the soul. There's a lot of different names for it, but the older you get, the more you begin to hopefully identify with that aspect of yourself, and the less you begin to identify with the wrinkly meat that is currently acting as the habitat within which that infinite wind can frolic. So, anyway, I'm pretty excited today because I just recorded this really cool podcast with someone. It's the first time that he's ever been on the podcast. His name's Ian Lawton, and he's working on a movie right now called The Dharma Bum, whose main character, Dharma Loca, was the first, basically the first white guy to become a Buddhist monk. So it's a really cool story. He's going to talk about it. I don't want to give away too much of it, but it really is a fascinating story. And we had a cool conversation that wasn't just about this movie, but got into some interesting and inspiring places. I hope that you will forgive me for going against what I just said in the beginning of this podcast by saying that I considered paying attention to your birthday a form of idolatry, and allow me to be the most absolute hypocrite on planet Earth by getting really nostalgic and sentimental for a moment with you guys, and saying to all of you how much you mean to me and how incredibly grateful I am to all of you that you listen to this podcast and have allowed me to make a job out of having conversations with so many wise, fascinating, interesting, and beautiful people. I really do think this is the best birthday I've ever had in my life, and that's a lot of that is because of the connection that I have with all of you guys. And the fact that I get to do this regularly, and that it actually sustains me here in this dimension. That is mind-blowing, and so I hope you all really understand just how grateful I am to you and how much I love you, even if I haven't met you, and how much happiness you bring to me and in this incarnation. Thank you so much. So sappy when you're worshiping time. Oh my God, the prayers to time inevitably sound just like that, nostalgic and sappy and sentimental. But you know what? Sometimes that's okay. You don't always have to be cool. You don't always have to be strong. You don't always have to have that steely prison expression as you wince away the deep feels that come from existing in a dimension where everyone around you is going to die. From time to time, you gotta let your heart squirt out some of that sweet, sappy stuff. Or what are you doing? You're not running your engine on all cylinders, man. You can't always be in locked up raw. Sometimes you gotta be in freed out and cooked, or whatever the opposite of locked up raw is. God, I'm sorry I said that. But I'm not gonna delete it, because I'm getting ready for my tour, and I don't have a lot of time to spend doing any kind of opening rant, and really it doesn't matter because I just had such a wonderful chat with Ian, and I'm excited for you guys to hear it. Okay, well, we're gonna dive right into it, but first, you know what's happening, some very quick business. This episode of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast is brought to you by Harry's.com. Harry's, they're purveyors of some of the finest, most high-tech razor blades that exist in this node of the multiverse. Now, listen, you might ask, how does some bearded hippie know anything about razor blades? I'll tell you, friend. How do I know about razor blades? I know about razor blades because, for whatever reason, my genetics enjoy creating plumes of greasy, oily, black pubic hair from every quadrant of my body, including this area right above my beard, which I shave down, because if I don't, the hair will grow right up to my eyes, Planet of the Apes style. I have to get razor blades. When I get razor blades, when you're in a pinch for razor blades, it sucks if you've got to drive down to the local meat market retail store and wait behind a thick plexiglass locked case that is placed there theoretically because shoplifting razor blades is very popular these days. So they feel like they've got to guard these things like it's the Ark of the fucking Covenant. So you stand there waiting for some angry manager to come and flip through his keys. If you're like me, you probably have to pee. And you're holding in your piss as this manager shakingly, unslowly unlocks this thick plexiglass case and withdraws from it some random overpackaged crap thing that you're picking out, not because you have any idea why, but just because it's more colorful than the other crap things in the case. Then you go shuffling up to the front of the store. You end up paying what you know is the most exorbitant price possible for what can't be that big a deal, but is packaged as though you're buying a piece of what fell out of the Roswell spaceship. You feel like you're getting, they make it seem as though you're buying a cube of alien technology that is not only going to get the hair off of your face, but is going to improve your life and relationships and allow you to truly become a man. If you've seen any of these goddamn razor blade commercials where these rough-hewn cowboy-style gentlemen use these high-tech glistening silver blades to groom themselves, and that subconsciously are transmitting to you the idea that if you use this razor blade, you're going to have some kind of facial symmetry, then you know what I'm talking about. The whole thing is a big, stupid scam that we've all gotten sucked into, and it ain't cool, friends. It ain't cool, which is why you got to go to Harry's.com. Use offer code FAMILYHOUR to get $5 off the amazing razor blades that they are creating over there. These are high quality, high performing German blades crafted by shaving experts. It's a better shave that respects your face and your wallet. I'm reading off the thing now. No more poor quality blades. Efficient business model allows for factory direct pricing at a fraction of drugstore costs. Plus, no pesky plexiglass cabinets. They do suck. These guys really have identified something that sucks. So if you get a starter set, you're going to get, for $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and three razor blades. Why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades when it's half the price at Harry's? So here's the thing, friends. I've used these blades. They sent me these blades, and these blades satisfy a few needs for me. Number one, and this is embarrassing, but I like getting weird packages in the mail. It's pretty cool to get a fancy-ass old-school box of razors and a cool blade and old-school shaving cream. That's really cool. Number two, they're really good, and I've used them, and they definitely are better than the razor blades that I've bought at stores. There is a difference. Forgive me for parroting what I'm sure you consider to be a bunch of crap, but there is a variance in shaving experiences offered to you in this dimension. And when I was in college, I remember I went to India and actually got a shave using a straight razor in like a weird like bowl of like handmade shaving cream in India. It was really cool and scary. It was scary. I'll admit it. There's something scary about some guy in Dharamsala with a fucking straight razor smacking at your face and slicing the hair off, because who knows who this guy is? I don't know what could happen. Anything could happen. It's scary no matter what. When you're around any man with a straight razor, it's kind of fucking spooky. If you're at a barber shop and you're getting the old school hipster straight razor shave, you don't know who's shaving you. You don't know the guy who's shaving you in downtown Eagle Rock. You don't know what's in that guy's basement. You don't know what's that, where that fucking razor has been, friend. That straight razor when you're down at the old school hipster barbershop and the guy's got all the dice tattoos on his hand. That guy, that, you know what I'm talking about. The new breed of barber. And I got nothing against barbers. In fact, I'm dear friends with my sweet, sweet barber who works at the New California Barbershop on Sunset Boulevard. Free plug, inside a plug. But I don't get him to shave my face with a straight razor, though I would. And I only trust him because I've been there many times. The point is, it's scary for another man to shave your face, which is why these razor blades that Harry's offer are so freaking cool, because they give you the exact same kind of experience. It's that same kind of shave. When you leave after getting shaved down by a pro shaver using a high-tech razor blade, there is a big difference in the way your face feels. Allow yourself the experience. Go to harrys.com. Support them because they support this podcast. Use coupon code FAMILYHOUR. You will get $5 off these blades. It's also a cool gift for friends in your life who shave all the time. And I wouldn't recommend it if I didn't use it. So give it a shot. Go to harrys.com. Use offer code FAMILYHOUR and you will get $5 off these sweet, beautiful blades. I don't know if they're sweet. Definitely don't taste them. But you know what I mean. All right. Great. There's our ad. Dear friends, as many of you know, and for those of you who live in different parts of the world and country, I'm sorry for repeating these commercials about the tour, but I gotta do it. We're going on tour. There's only 2 shows with tickets left. Praise Allah. We've sold out all the other ones. Arlington and Philadelphia. So on the 22nd of April, I'm going to be in Arlington at the Arlington Draft House with Abby Martin. And I'm going to be at the Trocadero Theater in Philadelphia on the 24th with Johnny Pemberton. I really hope you guys will make it out. If you're in either of these spots and are thinking about coming, get tickets now. The shows do sell out, and it sucks when people can't get in. I hope to see you there. And we have added Michael Daner as a guest on the show in Philadelphia. He is a meditation teacher who was a drug dealer in Afghanistan during the 60s. I had a long chat with him, was introduced to him through Raghu Marcus. He's super cool. So the combination of Johnny, Michael, and I is going to be pretty badass. I really hope you guys will come to the show. Were you aware of the fact that... Are you aware of the fact... The question is, are you aware? That's the first question. If you are aware, are you aware that in a great many indigenous traditions, there's the concept of poisonous darts that can get thrown through the multiverse and embed themselves into your astral body, causing you endless suffering, sorrow, and discontent. It's true. They call it the evil eye. And in Europe, there are so many various bits of jewelry that you could wear to shield yourself from the dark glare of the Pleiahaida, who shoots his or her poisonous dart into your soul every time they look at you with a sense of contempt or jealousy or anger or whatever it is, whatever bit of poo they happen to be slinging at your soul. This is why I have created, with the help of the local, God, who cares if an artist is local? They're just wonderful no matter what. And this artist is wonderful. Ron Rigi, the amazing artist, created for me a sigil, which has within it so many varying symbols that are designed to shield you from the shower of crap that can come spraying into your soul from all the sleeping, sad, and angry people that sail through this life like living cacti, shooting their dark thorns into the hearts of all those that they pass. These shirts, not only will they shield you from the poisonous darts of the contemptuous Pleiahaida, but they will also draw to you so many incredible extra-dimensional beings that if you are clairvoyant and psychic, you may see them flying out of the wood paneling of your school or home or rising up from the floor of whatever your job happens to be and landing on your shoulder and whispering sweet mantras into your ear like, you are perfect. You deserve love. You are love. Eat more chocolate. Enjoy orgasms more. They'll say a lot of different things, and if you don't like what they're saying, you can always tell them to go away. But these shirts are truly magnets for good energy and shields against the dark. And if you don't believe in all that nonsense, then they just have a really badass design on them that contains within it a lot of powerful symbols that Ron Rigi put together after we had a conversation. So I hope that you will go to DuncanTrussell.com and visit the store and pick up some of these t-shirts for you and your loved ones so that you can identify yourself as a listener of the DTFH and shield yourself from witches. And when I say witches, I don't mean the stereotypical version of witches, but the Hollywood bad witches. There's good witches too. Let me rephrase. I want to be politically correct when it comes to witches because some of my dearest friends are actual witches. Dark witches will no longer be able to penetrate your soul, and the light witches will be drawn to you, and the light will be drawn to you, and there will be a rainbow in your heart most of the time. Can't guarantee it, though. That's a real fizzled advertisement, isn't it? Oh, well, I don't have time to edit. I gotta keep forging ahead. And let me not forget one final ad. Forgive me, you all sweeties. Please go through our Amazon portal located at DuncanTrussell.com. If you're planning on buying something from Amazon, Amazon is one of the top, if not the top, dispensary of material items that exist in the current multiverse that we've incarnated into. And if you want one of those items, from a new pair of shoes to a hat to some kind of strange chemical, whatever it is you're longing for, it's at Amazon.com. That's guaranteed. Might I advise picking up a drone? Those are super cool. Why don't you have a drone? You realize that you could actually buy a flying machine that you can precisely control using your phone just by going through the Amazon portal. Computers, books, whatever it is you need, music, please just go through the Amazon portal located at DuncanTrussell.com. They will give us a small percentage of anything that you purchase, and it costs you nothing. It's a great way to support the podcast, and so many of you have been doing that, and I'm very grateful to you. Thank you so much. I know I say it again and again and again, but it really is one of the top ways to support this show. So please, bookmark the Amazon portal. Go through the Amazon portal and tell your friends about the Amazon portal. My God. An Amazon portal, and go through the real Amazon portal sometime. Head down to Peru and slurp back some ayahuasca. I've made the decision. I'm definitely going to do it. I'll talk about that more in a later podcast. In the meantime, go through our Amazon portal digitally, won't you? Now, everyone, please, if you will, settle down wherever you happen to be. Realize that you are being supported by the earth. Understand that every single facet of the universe is there to teach you to let go, open up, and experience ever accelerating, exponentially increasing levels of orgasmic bliss. And if you can't do that, just take a deep breath, because that always feels good. Chris Ryan just tweeted something about how if you breathe through your stomach, you get more air, and it does feel good. Isn't it amazing? We don't even know how to breathe. You breathe in, you puff your stomach out and let that sweet air suck down into your lungs and fill your body. Do it now. Expand your astral body and understand that you are part of a net of connections that doesn't just expand across this planet that we are in, but actually expands through the entire universe. And everything you do is just a micro undulation of the breathing of time and everything else. Also, it's fun. I don't even know what I'm saying at this point. I'm basically trying to welcome to the podcast a new friend of mine straight from Ireland. He's working on a movie about, you already heard me say this in the beginning. I'm not going to repeat it. He's working on an awesome movie. You can go to DuncanTrussell.com. There are links in the comments section of this podcast where you can find out more about how to help him get this movie made. And just find out more about him in general. It's all going to be there. But now, everyone, please open your third eyes. Get those pineal glands sprinkling that sweet organic DMT juice into your brain so that you can extend your psychic tendrils and embrace Ian Lawton. Please welcome Ian Lawton to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. Hare Krishna. Ian Lawton, welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. How are you?
I'm good, man. An absolute pleasure to be talking to you, sir.
Where are you right now?
I'm in a small town in the Midlands of Ireland, in the county of Meath.
Man,
and, I don't know if you know this place. Have you ever heard of Meath?
No, I never have. I've never been to Ireland.
Oh, you've never been? Okay. Well, you should come. I'll show you around.
I'd love to. And isn't it crazy to think that you are in Ireland and I am in the United States and we are communicating via Skype instantaneously? That is nuts if you think about that.
It is. Modern technology is certainly blows me away in what we're capable of doing. I mean, even me putting together this sort of campaign that I'm running now, and that this kind of technology has allowed me to talk to the likes of yourself and talk to people all over the world. It's incredible.
And this really, this is your crowdfunding campaign for the movie you're trying to make, the Dharma Bomb.
The Dharma Bomb. That's right.
Now, this is I was connected to you. I know you know this, but for everyone listening, I was connected to Ian via Raghu because he's working on a movie about a kind of, I guess you'd say, an unknown saint, an unknown Buddhist saint. Is that fair to say?
Well, sainthood isn't really applicable to Buddhism, though, is it?
But
really?
Aren't we allowed to make whoever we want a saint? I mean, isn't it?
Well, to me, he's an absolute hero, and
there we go.
And the fact that he's he's influenced my life greatly 100 years after his death, that and I want to tell the world his story I guess says a lot for his legacy, really.
Now, what's his name?
Well, he had a few names. He was born Lawrence Carroll in the year 1856 in a small town in the south of Dublin called Booterstown. And I just go ahead and start telling you about him.
Well, yeah, I mean, why don't you describe what it was like in Ireland in 1856?
1856, Ireland was, it wouldn't have been, for an Irish native, it wouldn't have been the most pleasant place to live. It was in the midst of the British colonialist rule, their first colony. So being born in 1856, it would have been a country that was sort of under the thumb of both the British and the Catholic Church. So, so you're a very kind of a repressed people, a very stifled kind of existence. You were just living to work, really. And so the church really had a stranglehold on people, and the British had a stranglehold on the government and how the country was run.
What kind of stranglehold did they have? What do you mean the church had a stranglehold? What were they? They weren't burning witches or anything, were they?
Let's see. To go back into to Irish history, they were very domineering. Well, to put it to you this way, that a lot of things are coming to light nowadays, all these years later, from the activities that the Catholic Church in Ireland got up to, from child abuse. I mean, there recently, over in the West, there was corpses of, I think, something like 500 babies were found in a septic tank in the grounds of an old church. You know, so they would cover up lots and lots of stuff. There was, I don't know if you know of the Magdalene laundries, where women who became pregnant out of wedlock were treated like absolute scum by the church. Uh-huh. And like their babies were ripped out of them and taken away. Wow. And sometimes ended up in a septic tank, you know?
Wow.
You know, it was just woeful, the treatment of, and it's only in the last few years with the Ryan Report and things like that, where the abuse that the Catholic Church had on the people of this country back then, and everyone kept it very quiet and kept it secret. I mean, the secret was kept really safe.
So people were keeping quiet that the Catholic Church had invaded Ireland and had started a kind of organized campaign of that involved child sacrifice.
Well, that's probably going a bit too extreme. It was just if a woman was impregnated out of wedlock, she was, you know, it was a sin, and sin was a real, like, the worst thing you could commit, like getting pregnant, like the most natural thing to happen to a woman who lays with a man is considered to be the most disgusting thing to occur.
I just want to the septic tank filled with babies.
Yeah.
The idea is the Catholic Church killed those babies?
Well, they were removed from the women who were pregnant.
So these were like late term abortions.
They were keeping them secret. You know, they were like, this was all kept kind of behind closed doors, because, you know, and they were called illegitimate children as well. And
because this is a thing, you know, it's just interesting to me that, and I know the term child sacrifice sounds like I'm being majorly sensationalist here, but I have noticed that people who tend to sacrifice children never call it child sacrifice. They always have different names for it, but it basically is the same thing, from sending soldiers to parts of the world to get exploded, to getting like young people to like give themselves brain damage through playing football, or all the various ways that power structures tend to destroy youth for their own energies. Never are they called child sacrifice. There's always different. They always have hilarious names for the child sacrifice. In this case, what was it you were saying that was called illegitimate? They had a different
illegitimate
name.
Illegitimate children.
Yeah, they were just,
if they're not born within wedlock, yeah, they're considered illegitimate.
Yeah, that's right.
Which means they cannot be buried in consecrated ground and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, gotcha.
And so they're just disposed of as if they were trash.
Oh, I
gotcha.
That's
what they did. Yeah.
Yeah, I gotcha. And then, you know, God only knows what other stuff was going on, you know. And I don't mean to do any Catholic bashing. I actually saw a statistic of how in the various denominations of Christianity and world religions, there is a disturbing amount of pedophilia that goes on. But
that's a huge component to this as well. Yeah.
We can't even imagine you know, back then when there was no internet, no way to get this information out, and when the church had such great power that even if you dared to mention that a priest had been fucking a kid, that was it for you, man. You would probably end up in jail or worse. So we can't even imagine the other terrible things.
That's precisely the stranglehold that we were talking about earlier is that they had on the populace, you know?
Well, there we go, man. I think that's a pretty good setting of the scene. Imagine if where you live right now, whoever you are that's listening, imagine if where you live right now had a Christian version of the Taliban that was being supported by a superpower and had taken over your country and driven you into a life of shame and misery and sadness. Is that that? Mm. That's it?
Yeah, I kind of want to preface this as well, that even though this story has a lot of sort of anti-Christian, anti-Catholic kind of sentiments, I don't have a problem with people who find solace in the teachings of Christ and things like that. You know, if that's your thing and that works for you, then more power to you. It's just when you use it to demean and abuse other people, like when it comes to equal rights, like the right to for gay marriage, etc. When you use it for bigotry and hide behind your, you know, that the book that they hold sacred for, you know, that is what I have a problem with.
Yeah, yeah.
I just thought, you know, Christ was a righteous dude. He was a cool guy. You know, if you strip away all the kind of supernatural elements. I think he had a lot of beautiful things to say.
Even with the supernatural elements, he was a cool guy. I don't know if you've heard that song. Jesus could have turned. What does it say? Jesus turned water into wine. He could have turned something. I'm gonna misquote it. He could have turned grass into marijuana if he wanted to. He was a great guy, and I love the miracles, and I love all of it. And I think the people who are listening to the podcast know how I feel about that. But I'm also fascinated by the way that this amazing drama of Satan and God gets played out, you know, and it sort of lends credence to the notion of some supernatural demonic force when you see that. This energy in the universe, it is the energy of dissipation, corruption, debilitation. This energy likes to wear the mask of its opposite and parade around as its opposite, doing the most atrocious and vile things throughout the world in the name of its enemy. It really is an incredible formation that happens in the symbol structures that we call organized religion, and it happens in such a perfect and incredible way that to me it's awe-inspiring, and it's so spooky that here you have this religion of love, peace, empathy, healing, and it gets reflected into the universe through people who are dead asleep and transformed into its opposite, and that is just amazing, and people get sucked into that tornado. Generations of people get sucked into this cyclone, which is the reversal of the very thing they think that they are worshiping. It's like generations of people who think that the shit at the salad bar is ice cream, and they've taught each other to just take big scoops of shit and smile while they're eating and be like, "Ooh, isn't this shit good? Ooh, you better say it's good or you're gonna go to hell. Don't you love it? Mmm, it's delicious." That's what it is. When right there at that very salad bar on the other side, if you go to the root of what most of these religions are, it's just the sweetest, most delightful, delicious, sustaining thing ever. But you never get to that side of the salad bar because it's being guarded by men and women dressed like penguins.
Yeah, I mean, I personally had my fill of those during my childhood. I was raised Roman Catholic. So I had I was taught by nuns and again by Christian brothers, and I never ended up in any kind of sexual kind of abuse, which a lot of people did, but I was certainly physically and mentally abused by these people.
Yeah,
it was tough. Now we're talking about like late 70s, early 80s, so it's in sort of recent history.
So imagine even now, I mean, I'm sure there's people, I know so many people who have been, psychologically abused via Catholicism, that it's
I'm nearly 44 years of age and I still suffer from Catholic guilt.
Yeah, they get you, man.
Just beaten into me as a child.
They get you.
It's abuse, you know.
They get you right there too. And they get you right when your neurons are forming, you know, they get you right when you're, you know, I can't remember the name of this wonderful chemical that I really want to find, but apparently there's this new drug that you can take that puts your brain into the state that kids are at when they're learning, because you're more wide open then, and you're the way that it's fascinating drug. And, you know, people say that when you're on it, you have to be very, very careful to have your phone turned off and to be in a place where you're not going to get disturbed, because whatever is happening is going to imprint, into your brain with more intensity than otherwise. So that, I think that's the state that kids constantly live in. Their brains are wide open and they're getting so deeply imprinted neurologically by whatever they happen to be around, that when they're around this, you know, generational form of conditioning that has as one of its primary methods the use of fear and shame and guilt, that you end up with some circuits in your motherboard that just are only going to produce in you for your entire life varying shades of what you're talking about, until you figure out a way to dissolve those circuits and rewire them. So many people I've met. So this is, to me, it's fun to talk about this stuff in relation to your story, so that people fully understand what our hero was born into, because no doubt he must also have been laboring under this strange combination of resentment and respect and shame and fear that Catholicism seems to stamp onto so many people's souls.
Well, here's the thing. He was born right next door to the local Catholic church. So he was right in there on the front lines. And I think that kind of prompted him to, because he became an alcoholic very quickly.
Right.
I think early teens, he really hit the bottle. So obviously there's some kind of abuse or some kind of whatever in his background before he left the country. And he left the country very early. I think about 17 or 18 years of age, he made his way. Because Booterstown is very near Dunleary. And Dunleary is a port town. So that got him over to Liverpool in England. And he was working on the docks over there. And because back in Dublin, he was the son of the local greengrocer. So that kind of experience got him a job on the ship's pantry on the Liverpool docks, which in turn took him to New York. And New York around that time was like Gangs of New York, you know, the Scorsese movie.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was that kind of that we're talking about that kind of time. And so he was traveling in a time with no passport. So he was changing his name left, right and center. And he kind of bummed his way across the USA then once he got to New York, sort of living hand to mouth, being a real bum, hobo, jumping trains, you know. Being a beatnik way before beatniks were invented.
Right.
And again, his shipping skills got him onto the fruit ships of the Sacramento River. So he was working his way up and down there till he got to San Francisco. And in San Francisco, then he started working the ships again, which brought him to Japan, the shipping route to Japan, the commerce route there.
Wow.
And the story goes that on sort of the third trip, returning from Japan to San Francisco, him and his mate were kicked off the boat for drunken disorderly conduct, and just, you know, he woke up hungover on the beach watching his ship sail away back to New York, leaving him there alone.
God, you're so fucked. Like, can you imagine how fucked you are? Like, you are so fucked, because this isn't, there's no air. You're not going to catch a plane back. Like, you are screwed, man. You are deeply, deeply fucked if you find yourself in the hundreds of years ago on a beach in Japan with an alcoholic just shipwrecked in another country. He definitely didn't speak Japanese, right? There's no way.
No, Not at all. This was like his only third time in Japan.
Oh, wow. And
I'd say he was only probably there for an afternoon, maybe stayed overnight before heading back. So on this time, he just, the crew had enough of him and kicked him off the boat and left him there.
Wow.
Apparently,
how much of an asshole do you have to be to get kicked off a boat in Japan? Like, you must, like, because really, I mean, you got to be, like, really doing some awful stuff for a people on a boat to be like, look, man, we're going to have to shipwreck you in a completely different country because you're that much of an asshole.
I know, it's crazy to think that, yeah. And to think where he ends up as well later on in his life. But the weird thing is that he ended up, he made his way to Burma somehow, going all the way down through Southeast Asia, fueling his alcohol, you know, living hand to mouth, continuing his bumming about, and working along the coastline of Southeast Asia till he got to Burma, where he was working as a tally clerk, apparently. I'm not exactly 100% sure what a tally clerk does, but it's something to do with taking tickets or whatever.
Weird.
But he came across a flyer that explained Buddhism, a tract that explained Buddhism. Obviously, Burma was a huge Buddhist country at the time.
Yeah.
Not at the time, but obviously is. So he made his way to a local monastery after reading a little flyer about Buddhism. And the local Buddhist took him in. And he dried out. They had such a profound effect on him that he quit the bottle and he dried out.
Wow.
And after he decided to become an apprentice monk. And after 5 years as an apprentice, he in I think it was June of 1900, he was the first ever white man to be ordained Buddhist monk.
Now that's documented. That's for sure. Like in the world, this is the first yes. Caucasian to become a Buddhist.
First guy.
That's nuts. That's incredible that we even know that. That's an amazing thing that we even know who that is. But that is wild. I mean, that is an epic moment in the history of that's an epic moment in history to think that.
Yeah. I mean, he's like the missing link really to Western Buddhism.
Whoa. You
know? And it's all thanks to these fantastic professors. There's these three professors who have managed to piece this guy's life together. Like I said earlier, he was living in a time without passports, so he was constantly changing his name and had aliases. So for them to be able to piece together his life from these fragments of information and figuring out that they were talking about the right person is just astonishing.
That is amazing to think that the first white Buddhist became a Buddhist because he was too much of an asshole to stay on a boat.
That's one way of putting it, I guess.
Crazy.
I mean, he certainly had a whirlwind of a life leading up to that point. But to be honest with you, that like him becoming a monk is just the beginning of this story. Is really what he did as a monk then that makes him a legend in my eyes. Pardon me, I've got some gas. I've just eaten my food, my meat dinner. Pardon me, I'm belching.
No problem, man. You don't have to say you're sorry. This is a podcast. You can burp for the next 15 minutes and nobody's going to care that much.
But getting back to this guy, he was, like I said, him becoming a monk is really just the beginning of the story. Because at the time when he became a monk in 1900, Burma was in the process of being colonized by the British. And him coming from a British colony, he really took umbrage with this. He fell in love with Buddhism so much that and it really profoundly affected his life so much so that he quit the bottle. The transformation from a drunken bum to a Dharma bum is you know, extraordinary. And for him to see the British come in and try to destroy this thing that he discovered that's so sacred to him, he really took offense and umbrage to this. And how the British were doing this, how they sort of softened the blow of their colonization, was to send in missionaries first and foremost,
right,
to convert the Buddhists to Christianity in order for them to sort of make the job of taking over their country easier.
Right.
So that's essentially who Damaloka, sorry, his name became Damaloka after he was ordained. His ordained name was Udamaloka.
What does that mean? Does that mean anything?
In certain things I've read, people have said it's the Irish Pongy, but I think that may have been just a nickname that he had because of him. He went on preaching tours all up and down Southeast Asia. So and because he was a white man with a shaved head and in saffron robes, he was an oddity. He became a real celebrity.
Yes. It's a great hook. It's a great hook. Like, you're definitely going to sell tickets if you're the first white monk anyone's ever seen. That's definitely.
He'd steal so much thunder as well. Like Lord Curzon, that famous British emperor, like showing up at one point, showing up in this town where he's supposed to visit, and nobody was there to greet him because Damaloka was up the road and had stolen the entire audience, you know?
Amazing.
But so what he did was, like about a month or so after his ordination, he placed an ad in the local Burmese newspaper, which essentially stated he proclaimed himself to be the Bishop of Rangoon and forbade any Christian tracts or Bibles to be handed out in Burma, and said, "You're not allowed to do this by order of Udamaloka, the Bishop of Rangoon." Wow. I mean, he wasn't the Bishop of Rangoon. He just made that up just to give himself some sort of gravitas.
Wow.
But that was sort of the beginning of him sort of making his announcement publicly that you're not allowed to do this. And, you know, if you fuck with me, you're going down. I mean, this is one man standing up to the might of the British Empire.
Yeah. And the way he had to do it was by combating Christianity. And I think a lot of people hear that and they think, what the fuck? This is the all embracing. This is Buddhism. It's not supposed to be differentiating one religion from the other. But if you understand that it's not so much the Christianity that he was combating, it was the people who were wanting to use it as manacles to psychologically enslave people that were about to be invaded. Yes. And that's what he was fighting against, not the religion itself, it seems like.
Exactly, yeah. And obviously he'd witnessed the stranglehold back in his old country, you know, and I think he saw solidarity with these people who he let into his heart, and said, you know, this, I'm not going to let this happen.
I've seen what happens when they come.
Yeah, where they fucked up my country, I'm not going to let them fuck up yours, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And which is the most admirable thing, you know, I can think of.
And a dangerous, very dangerous thing to do,
and
too.
Very dangerous, yeah, absolutely. I mean, his first arrest, I mean, he started to cause, he was an anarchist, really, a total activist. And his first arrest was when he approached an off-duty police officer, British police officer, obviously, on the Shwedagon Pagoda. The Shwedagon Pagoda is sacred ground in Rangoon. And no shoes are allowed, essentially. When you walk in this area, you remove your shoes. That's just a given.
Yes.
Unless you're a police officer on duty.
Yes.
And he was there and approached an off-duty police officer who was wearing shoes, and he confronted him and demanded that he remove his shoes, that you're disrespecting everyone here, and remove your shoes. And the police officer is refusing, and Damaloka came out with the line, "You've trampled all over their country. Now you're going to trample all over their religion." And they threw him in jail for that. He was arrested and dragged off to jail because obviously people started to gather, and you know, they were very afraid of sedition, and that was one of the charges that he ended up getting. He was charged with sedition later on. I mean, it was from 1900 to roughly 1911. That was sort of his reign of terror, if you like.
Right.
And so it was just a little over a decade where he was. I mean, he ended up being under police surveillance no matter where he went when he went on his preaching tours. all through Sri Lanka and places like that. I mean, he was so ahead of his time. He was in China. He opened up one of the first multicultural schools for English. I mean, he did so much stuff. A lot of stuff sort of fell apart. He was very good at sort of setting up things like the Buddhist Tract Society, which was a publication where he'd hand out free tracts. Tracts are like, you know, newsletters, that kind of thing.
Because here's the thing, man. People don't understand. Sorry to cut you off. For us, modern humans, whatever that means, the notion of Buddhism or the idea of Buddhism is not, I mean, it's like, yeah, we see Buddhist monks at the airport. There's Buddhist textbooks or Buddhist books everywhere. There's so much. So Buddhism is just immersed itself in all the cultures of the world. But at this time, I don't think people were so aware of it. They didn't know what it was at all. So people hadn't been introduced to these ideas, which if you've ever studied Buddhism, you quickly realize how different a religion this is compared to most other religions, because it seems to be more of a process than a religion. It's more of a series of exercises.
It's a philosophy, really, isn't it?
It's a philosophy, and it's a kind of you know, they say that you take up the Dharma, and the Dharma, you take up these ideas. In other words, it's not like I just believe this is real and I don't understand it. It's like you
not rules to follow. It's just a path to live, really.
Yeah, and you have to digest it. And the more that you digest it, the more your former self begins to transform. Not because you have taken a leap of faith so much, is because you've begun to assimilate these very, very powerful truths into your life that quite often run counter to the way most of society thinks. You know, so much of society is based on the individual. So much of society is based on power trips and the ego, and so much of society is based on differentiation. When Buddhism, it seems, at least my encounters with it, it produces a kind of dissolution of the boundaries between me and everything else. And it does it in a very systematic, almost surgical way. So it's kind of cool that nobody really knew about this. And that's what's so amazing about this story to me, is that here you have this guy was infected basically with this information, and then he started transferring it all over the world. And his ability to transfer it was maybe a little more potent than other people, because back in the day, I think people listened to it. Was just, it's so unique. He's you got a Buddhist honky here, man. So he's like, this is a powerful thing. Like, it's, people are going to listen, even though what he's saying is probably no different than the message that's been transmitted from the universe for thousands of years, just because of his special identity in relation to this time period. He was an excellent, excellent amplifier of this information.
Yes.
Which is pretty cool.
I 100% agree.
And that, you know, the thing, that here's another thing that I'd love to talk with you about is just how, like, I think as individuals, it's really hard for us to imagine, like, little old me, I'm just a drunk, you know, like whatever your particular miasma that you found yourself stuck in, whoever you are listening right now, and everyone's got their own little tar pit they're stuck in. You look at the tar around your feet, whether it's the shitty relationship, the depression, the addiction, the disease, the whatever it is, you know, the thing that you think you're stuck in. And then while being stuck in this stuff, you no doubt experience from time to time these moments of feeling like you've got a really important thing to do in this world that doesn't involve making money. Like, you get that, you know what I'm saying? That sense of like, shit, man, I feel like I can help people in around me. And it's a weird feeling if you're a drunk. It's a weird feeling if you're an addict. It's a weird feeling if you just finished throwing a vase across the room because you were in a fight with your husband or your wife. It's a weird feeling when you perceive yourself as being covered in the tar of this, of Maya. And suddenly coming into you is this sense of like, there is a greater path for me than this, but look at me. I'm a fucking asshole. I'm not, who do I think I am? I'm not Gandhi. And so that's another beautiful thing about this story is here you have someone who was so wretched, so fucking wretched, a drunk, so wretched, but he came into contact with this information and, not only transformed his own life, but became an actual threat. Is it safe to say he was a threat to one of the largest empires on the planet?
I think it was, considering they erased him from history deliberately, would suggest that they felt threatened by his words and his actions.
Erased from history by the fucking empire. Think about that. That is so wild. Like, nothing better can happen to you than for some power structure to erase you from history. That is like way better than sending flowers to your funeral. That's like, you are so potent and so dangerous to the paradigm we were trying to transmit into the world that we are going to try to wash you off of the chalkboard of time if we can. That's pretty badass.
Absolutely. And that's precisely the reason why I want to make this movie, that I want his legacy to be known by as many people as possible.
Yeah, well,
Please,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that my apologies, Duncan, I've lost my train.
Oh, no problem, man. I do it all the time. I constantly smoke marijuana, so that's like just par for the course. Usually when that happens to me, I just go, and try to think of something remotely. But really, here's the thing, man. Are you familiar? Have you ever, when I was in college, I read this book, The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. Have you ever read that book?
No, I've read other Dostoevsky. I haven't read Brothers Karamazov.
It's great, man. And there's one of my favorite essays in there is about Saul of Tarsus, who was, I guess you could say he was one of the first Christian missionaries. So he, interestingly enough, in a lot of ways, there's a parallel between our hero here and the first Christian missionary, Paul. His name was Saul. And he was someone who, like, back in the day, it was very popular and fun to throw rocks at early Christians because I don't know. I guess they were obnoxious back then, or people were just like, shut the fuck up about Jesus. And they would, like, throw rocks at them. And so one of these persecutors of the Christians was this person named Saul, and the story goes, he's walking down the road to Damascus, has a vision of Jesus Christ, who says to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And in this moment of contact with the Christ consciousness, he has a personal transformation. He goes blind, becomes Paul. He's sent to Damascus, runs into some Christians, and he's the person who founded the early Christian church, which is really interesting. And a lot of people say what we see in the post-Gospels and the epistles is actually not Christianity. It's called Pauline theology, which is a translation of Christianity. But it's really an interesting story. And the parallel is, here you have a scumbag who likes to throw rocks at very sweet people, meets this incredible potent consciousness and transforms to become one of the great missionaries of the particular religion that he was associated with. It's an archetype, I guess. But Dostoevsky, in this essay, he ponders what happened in that moment of transformation. Did Jesus, or whatever spirit he encountered that came down from the sky, touch him? in such a way that it created a kind of atomic shift or a metaphysical shift inside of him that he couldn't have done anything about. There was no way to resist it. There was no way to stop it. You just get touched on the heart by our sweet Lord Jesus and bang, you're a better person. If so, then this is a very dire appraisal of Christianity, and we're in a lot of trouble because it means Jesus is just some kind of alien that can shoot a spiritual healing beam at the dark part of your heart, and whether you like it or not, you're going to turn into a good person. Thus, all free will has been completely eradicated. And since Dostoevsky was an existentialist, a Christian existentialist, he said, no, what happened was Saul had this experience. Maybe he didn't have enough water to drink, or maybe, something happened neurologically, or maybe he ate the wrong wheat that had some fungus on it. Dostoevsky doesn't say that, but who knows what happens. Saul trips out, has this vision, and because he's finally had a vision, he uses it as the excuse to become his optimum self. And I love that. I love that idea because it's like, yeah, sure, Buddhism, great. The picking up the Dharma, great. Christianity, great. Islam, great. The visions, great. All of them, great, 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 great. But really, all they do is give you a perfect excuse to become a better person. That's it. And that becoming a better person, you're the one who does it. You're the one who does it. You're the one who pulls yourself out of the tar. And whatever symbol structure you want to use to do it, you get to pick. It's right there for you. You know what I'm saying? It's that goddamn imminent transformation that is floating in front of all human beings at any given moment that blows my mind. That at any second in this dimension, if you want to, you can achieve what unfortunately is an overused and misunderstood word, enlightenment, attainment. You can realize that we are inside the most divine, incredible, beautiful, sweet, smelling temple of time whenever you want. And it really doesn't matter which way you do it. It's just that you can do it. And in stories like this, which it sounds to me that this is a redemption story, are so inspiring because, man, it's really, I just think people just need to keep going back to the fact that this was a drunk who got thrown off a boat. This is a drunk who got thrown off a boat, like the bottom of the rung. That's pretty much the bottom of the rung there, man. You are a homeless man, a homeless alcoholic on a beach in Japan who transforms into one of the great modern Buddhist teachers of our time, threatens one of the great world powers, and gets erased from history until, thank God, someone like you comes along and is like, we're gonna get this information out there. And this is where it gets even more spectacular to me, is that the way that you're getting this information out there is using a brand new technology, which is broadcasting this story at this very moment around the entire planet. How wild is that, man? It's like this little seed that you've discovered. Now you've managed to use a technology that has only existed in the last maybe decade or so, 15 years, to reproduce it and amplify it and send it into the brains of so many people all around the planet. That's an incredible thing to think about to me. That's really fucking cool.
Wow, Duncan. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for getting this stuff out here, man. I think it's so cool to hear these stories, especially ones that no one's heard of. I never in my life have ever contemplated. Who was the first white person who got in touch with Buddhism? It's something no one even thinks about. No one even considers that. So it's really cool, man. And so
I mean, I was completely floored when I first read the information. And I was just thinking, like, why isn't this common knowledge? Why isn't he in our history books? Why isn't he in our textbooks? Why didn't I learn about this guy at school? You know, you got the likes of, you know, Oscar Wilde or Michael Collins or other sort of big names in Irish history, but Udamaloka has never existed in this sort of consciousness, you know. And he's known bits and pieces in academia, people who go out of their way to study history of religion, etc. And they're the only people who are aware of him at this point. And that's, I think he's too important a person. His story and his legacy and his you know, his lust for life, really, is he's up there with, you know, Lenny Bruce or Martin Luther King, people who just stood up for what they believed in despite any of the odds and just went for it with tenacity and righteous indignation and just...
Ah, righteous indignation.
Just with, you know, powerful, but the correct... You know what I'm trying to say?
Don't yes. You? Yeah. I do know what you're trying to say.
I become very inarticulate when I get passionately sort of emotional about this man, you know.
Well, it's fascinating in a way that you are like him. You feel the same way. You feel driven in the same way to get this story out there. You're transmitting. You have actually, it seems like, absorbed a lot of his energy and are.
It feels like that. Yeah.
Yeah,
it does. Feels like that. I mean, there's this old saying, and I don't know if it's a song lyric or whatever it is, whoever coined this phrase, but it's religion is for people who are afraid to go to hell, whereas spirituality is for people who've already been there.
Ah, yes, yeah, right.
And I don't know who coined that, but I live by that right now.
Oh, I love that.
And I can see that Damaloka, he went through his hell. And then came out the other side as, you know, reborn. I mean, that's your rebirth right there, isn't it?
Yeah, I look at, you know what I look at
that
it?
Transformational arc from a nobody to somebody so important and then to be...
And then back to a nobody for a little while.
Back to nothing. You know, the candle was just blown out until 2009, you know, 100 years later.
You know that thing you're saying about spirituality versus religion? You know what it reminds me of is right when, and you know, Ram Dass, of course, talks about, he's so good at articulating the idea of all these various channels that we can tune into at any given moment. And, but it does remind me, like, I'm old enough now, as you are, to remember when there was only 13 channels on the TV, or three main ones. And I can remember two. You'd be lucky there was one, like, I remember in North Carolina, we had this little TV, and if you got the antenna just right, you could tune into a station that had Doctor Who, but it would come through really fuzzy and foggy, and it was like still glory, like, oh my God, we got it. We got it for a second. It was amazing. And then cable happened, and then suddenly you get these crystal clear channels, and it was just like, oh my God, look at all these other things we could watch. And to me, that's kind of what spirituality is. It's those crazy moments in the midst of whatever your particular hell happens to be, whatever it is. And it doesn't have to be something as dramatic as alcoholism. It can just be the general sense of anxiety and emptiness that fills the hearts of anyone who's taken the smallest amount of time to consider the fact that they are going to die. It can just be that kind of aching thing of like knowing, like, you know, I love all these people around me, but they're all going to die. And so am I. I actually just saw somebody on Reddit asked, like, since like 10,000 BC, how many people have died? And, you know, obviously it's in the billions. It's everybody. So, you know, that at first can create a real aching sadness. And in the midst of that, spirituality is this tuning mechanism that suddenly says, yeah, okay, right, exactly. Oh, you're right. Terrible, terrible, terrible. Death, death, death. You're going to die. Everyone's going to die. Everyone will be erased from the chalkboard of time, regardless of what they do, because the entire planet is going to eventually be incinerated by a supernova or a comet or a meteor or some unknown source. There is no way to escape the singularity we're all plunging into. You're exactly right, and it's incredibly terrifying. And also, you're right, your relationships suck, your marriage is shit, your financial financially bankrupt. You're spiraling down into alcoholism. You're addicted to heroin. You're deeply, chronically, supremely depressed. Yes, you're right. You're right. You've got cancer. Yes, you're right. You've got hepatitis, whatever, herpes. Yes, you do. It's true you do. And it's scary and terrible. But here, let me show you this other channel. Click. And you turn to that channel. It's like, oh my God, this entire universe is the incense rising off of the altar of the divine. Everything is so beautiful. And even my own expiration, even my own dissolution, even my own fear, even the pain itself is incredible. Isn't it amazing? It's amazing. Sorry about that. But that's what it teaches you. That's the channel that you get. That's the thing that you can tune into, man. And that to me is just one of the most incredible, beautiful gifts that people like Dharmaloka give us.
Sorry, Duncan, I missed some of that there because you went, I went on hold for a second.
Oh,
I don't know if you.
Don't worry. It was just a ridiculous rant.
It was good. I just missed about 15 or 20 seconds there, and I didn't know what you were saying.
I was saying that we can tune into any frequency that, you know, there's a lot of other frequencies that we could tune into, and that the teachers, they allow us to tune into frequencies other than the miasmic, oily ones that a lot of us are stuck in.
Yes.
I guess that's it. I don't know.
And can I ask you a question?
Sure.
What is God to you? Because I'm an atheist, and I don't believe in God. I'd like to know more about what your opinion of what God is and what is God to you, because I know it's a personal thing, really, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, yeah, I think I negatively talk about atheists, and I never mean to.
I'm an atheist because, like, technically I am. To be honest, I don't identify with anything. I see myself as a human on planet Earth, and we're all one. And I practice Buddhism. I'm certainly a student of the teachings of the Buddha for sure. But I don't believe in God, and I don't believe in a deity.
Well, but
I know and I respect you, and I just like to know what is God to you?
Well, you know, the idea from the God that I know or understand or pray to or think about or feel connected to, there's a lot of different names for what that is, and some of them. You know, if you take any of them literally, obviously you're going to be like, this is a complete horseshit, because we're talking about, I mean, you know, you just have to look at where we at, what's going on here, right? What is going on here? And what's going on here is that based on everything that we understand, using the most advanced technology that we currently have, it appears that there was some outburst of energy billions and billions and billions of years ago that ended up cooling down, and in the cooling down process expanded infinitely and also formed all these accumulations of matter that we call planets and stars and comets. And somehow the spinning of these things and the input from random chaotic chance, whether it was meteor impacts or we don't know what, really, the combination of the spinning centrifugal force and being close enough to a burning ball of light and having sort of a hot core, the combination of all these things created this life-bearing simulacrum. Is that how you say it? Simulacrum that you know, organic life it came from, and then organic life complexified, and eventually it became us, and we feel love. And so for me, the leap of faith when it comes to God, or why I believe in God and how I believe in God, is I can't understand, I cannot accept the idea that life is only formed on this planet. It's impossible mm-hmm. for me to accept that idea. And based on the data coming in from the Kepler satellite, the telescope that's studying mm-hmm. Potentially habitable Earth-like planets in the Goldilocks region of stars, not too hot, not too cold, there it appears to be that there are zillions of them out there, just in the tiny little quadrant of the universe that we can see. And so if we are truly in an ever-expanding infinite universe, which I don't see how it couldn't be infinite, because what's the wall made of, you know? What's the wherever it stops, what's the boundary there, man? That's something too. Then it's an infinite boundary. But whatever it is, we must exist in an infinite universe. And if the infinite universe has as one of its qualities the production of sentient beings that are capable of unconditional love for each other in their highest moments on this planet, which is we're brand new on this thing, man. We just popped out of the womb of the Earth, and we've already gotten to the point where many of us at this very moment are taking bullets for our brothers and sisters just because we love them. People are dying for their children. People are dying for their friends. People are swimming and saving people in the ocean, even though they know they might drown. We know in this universe that level of love is possible and is happening. And if we exist in an infinite universe, then I think there must be an infinite spectrum of that kind of phenomena. And I think the sum total of all phenomena in that place where love reaches its maximum, infinite, ever-accelerating, exponentially increasing place is the point that I would call God. And that's what I pray to.
Gotcha. Do you read Carl Sagan?
I've seen Cosmos. I don't read a lot of Carl Sagan. I know he's incredible. I mean, I know.
Well, to me, the man was enlightened. To me, he was a Buddha. I mean, if you listen to the audiobook extract of Pale Blue Dot about how, you know, when he sent Voyager 1 off on its mission, and as it passed, I think it was as it was leaving the rings of Saturn, he decided to point the vessel back towards Earth and take a photograph of it, which was just that pale blue dot image. And what that, you know, the profound poetry that came out of him after seeing that image. I mean, it astounds me that, you know, in every hotel room drawer is a copy of the Holy Bible, yet Pale Blue Dot is out of print.
You know? Yeah, right. Well, you know, man. I know.
I mean, he said something as well, is that we are the universe's. I don't want to misquote the man there, but he says we are the universe's way of knowing itself.
That's right. That's right. Mm. And that's happening right now and every single person listening. And I don't think it's just limited to, and not that it matters that it's ever, even if it were just here, to me, it's still divine. It's still so sumptuous and sweet and something to, something so comforting. I think there's lots of ways to get to that point. And if you want to use matter or you want to focus solely on matter, then that is the flesh of this divinity. And written in the very inorganic matter of the planet that we are currently existing on is the story of billions and billions of years. And if you zoom in even deeper to that, then you see written within the very inorganic matter, the stones of this earth. If you zoom in deeper to the atomic or subatomic levels, then you start witnessing the miracle, which is that we are in a very slow-moving cloud of atomic phenomena that is capable of producing sense organs and life, and that, you know, the scripture is everywhere. So, and it's just right there for everyone to tune into. But on it, but I think for a lot of people, it's overwhelming. Like for a lot of people, it's like you want to be the kid at the slumber party when the parents have driven away for a second, and you get to have that feeling of not being watched over. It's kind of overwhelming, you know? We need the rebellious phase. We need that feeling of like, I'm a separate differentiated individual in the face of this thing. And that's a blast. And I think, but I think that, that ultimately is a, it can feel so, so, so empty and cold in relation to this other way of connecting, which is where suddenly you kind of do that thing they call surrender and allow yourself just for a second to be embraced by everything and to blend in with it and to become, you know, part of the sort of warp and weave of this exhalation that is happening, this miraculous exhalation. We are inside the first out-breath of God. That's us, you know? And you don't have to call it God. If you're a Catholic, man, I wouldn't call it God. I'd come up with my own name for it because that word, unfortunately, you know, that word is very similar.
That word is tainted. It makes me, for someone like me who grew up with under the thumb of Christian Brothers and stuff like that, the G word really doesn't do the right thing for
me. No way, brother. It's like, I could give me a baby. Give me any baby. And if you give me three, this sounds so fucked up, but if you give me 3 years with a baby, give me three babies for 3 years and I can make all three of them hate any word that you give me, whatever it is. You want me to, I can get them to hate the word butter. I can get them to hate the word night. I can get them to hate the word pillow. I could do, like, just take the word pillow. If you give me kids and just any kind of like just basic Skinnerian, like a Skinner box, and every time the word pillow is uttered, there's a nice electric shock that runs through their body. When they become older and somebody's like, hey, do you have you need an extra, can I have a pillow? They're gonna be like, ah, fuck, no, God, I don't use pillows. They suck, man. I'm never gonna lay on a fucking pillow. I use my hands. Pillows are awful. And it's the same thing. It's like that's the unfortunate, you know, repercussion, hopefully unintentional repercussion of this bastardized version of a beautiful philosophy, is that this tool, which is all the word God is, it's just a tool, man. It's a tool. It's a plug, or it's a connection point between you and the sentient divine aspect of the universe. But, you know, once you've been shocked, don't use the word anymore. Come up with a new one. Call it whatever you want, man. You get to invent that name.
I don't have a word for it, but I do feel the connection when I connect with the universe when I meditate. And that's where it really you can feel that. I mean, you mentioned Kepler there earlier, and I had it was recommended once in one sort of thing I was reading online to sort of keep a meditation journal, and I only did it once, and I made one entry, and if I can try and remember what I said, but it was if you think meditation to me is like when, I think it was the Hubble, they around the belt of Orion, there was an area of space where scientists believed there was absolutely nothing. So I think for 14 days they trained the Hubble, maybe it was Kepler, but I think it was the Hubble. For 14 days they trained and focused and spent all their attention on this area where they expected there to be nothing. When the photograph developed, they saw billions of more galaxies.
Yeah.
And that to me is just, that blows my fucking mind, man.
Yeah.
And that's what I get. Like I reach the edge of the observable universe internally when I meditate, and when and I feel that connection, because it's parallel within and without, you know, from, and it's like, you know, like that sort of an egg timer where the sand is dropping, that point right in the center between the top compartment and the bottom compartment, that is the center of your head, if you like, when you're meditating, and that connects you between the both universe within and without, and you realize you are everything.
Yes, that's it. I love it. That's God. To me, that's it, man. That's that feeling that, that is, you know, God is an easy word, man. It's a dumb word, really, when you think.
God.
It really does seem like something a dumb person would, like if a dumb, it really is like the sound you would make when you're experiencing that exhilarating sense of novelty. Like the first thing that's going to come out of your mouth is like, God. God, You know, it's like that. It almost is just like that. It's like the utterance of someone whose mind is getting blown. You know, it's like it's that thing. You know, You know that God. It's got that awe sound in it. You know that sound where you're like, wow. It's that. You know, it's not
the first word we say when we orgasm as well.
yeah, exactly. And before the word God came into popular use, you know, or before the whatever language, whatever it is in your language, or in all the languages of the earth, there was still that exhilarating sense of, it's like a combination of excitement and relief that happens when you realize that your every single thing that you think about how every single thing works is only one tiny, tiny, infinitesimal little piece of the way things really are. And for a brief second in this incarnation, we get the chance to glimpse that greater thing. And it's, what a relief. Fuck, man. I thought I knew everything. I really, really did. And oh, wow. It's totally different than what I thought. Like, it's so very, very different. And not different in a bad way, but different in a billion trillion times better than what you expected. It's like that that imminent surprise party that's waiting every single person in every moment. You know, when you come home from a shitty day of work and you open the door and all your friends are there and you're, you know, there's just this love comes blasting out at you and everyone's like, surprise! It's that thing. You know, at any moment, there's that chance to have the entire universe give you a surprise party where it's like, surprise! Check it out! This place is awesome! You thought it was shit, but it isn't. It's awesome. It's so filled with love and truth. And that's God, you know? And I don't care about the word. I just use it as a form of laziness, really. It's fun to pray too, man. Actually, it's like, it's really a blast to, like, you know, it's like, okay, we like SETI, you know, we were scanning the observable universe for signs of extraterrestrial life.
Yeah.
And one controversial move that some people want to do is they want to start blasting, I think, lasers or some like thing into the universe that like is saying to people, hey, we're out here, we're out here, we're out here. And some people are saying, you know, let's keep quiet about this place that we're at right now, because we don't know who we're contacting. Let's keep this under wraps. But so a person, an individual existing on this planet is in one of the most unique predicaments that I can think of in the known universe, which is that here we are, this sentient bit of thinking meat that has this deep, deep inner cosmos, subjective inner universe filled with all our memories, thoughts, and feelings. And we're surrounded by an external universe that seems to go on forever. So in the same way that it might be absolutely ridiculous and pointless to imagine that we can shoot lasers or information beams out into the sky in some random direction and someone might come back to us and say, hey, what's up? Oh, cool. We've been waiting for you guys to call. It's still definitely worth the effort, if you ask me. And in the same way, if you are a sentient bit of the universe experiencing itself, then wouldn't you want to run experiments that involved metaphysically trying to communicate with any form of disembodied, super intelligent sentience that might exist outside of your own self? And that's what prayer is. And why not give it a shot? Because, you know, maybe no one does write back, but a lot of people have reported that from time to time, somebody writes back right away, you know? And the way that they write back is not in the form of like hearing the voice of God, but the way they write back is a sudden explosive, occurrence of unpredictable yet beautiful synchronicities around you that are called miracles, you know? That's the way it writes back. And I think it's worth the experiment, you know? I think it's definitely worth the experiment to do. And and even if nothing happens, even if you pray, you can just wake up in the morning and go, thank you, God. You can't say that. say thank you, Carl, or whatever name you want to come up with. Thank you. You know, come up with a name for it. Thank you, Carl Sagan. Thank you, that which inspired Carl Sagan. Thank you, that thing at the quantum level of Carl Sagan that created the series of electrical events in Carl Sagan's brain to produce all of the works of Carl Sagan. Thank you, that point from which all inspiration emerges into the known universe. Thank you, that thing that allows human beings to express love. Whatever that is, just say thank you to it in the morning or at night. And who knows? Worst case, you just have said thank you to a phantom, you know, an imaginary friend. What's the big deal? It's still cool.
No, I get that when I'm out at night, I'm walking my dog, and I stand and look at the stars. That, you know, if you want to call that praying, and looking up and knowing there's so much that we don't know, that completely outweighs what we do know, and we know so much.
Yes, the dark matter, you know, and it's
and that space has weight. I mean, that was revealed there recently, but it was Lawrence Krauss. He said, even nothing weighs something.
That's awesome.
That's fucking amazing.
It's fucking amazing, man. And you know, it's to me, this is why I love Bhakti Yoga, because Bhakti Yoga acknowledges that one of the great pleasures in life is saying thank you. One of the great pleasures in life is when someone gives you something a million times more than you deserve, and you go, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. And they go, oh, it's nothing really, I love you. Like, that's such a fun interaction to have, and it's such a sweet interaction to have. And I think that some people rob themselves of this experience by negating the potentiality of a Godhead. And just allow it for a second. Nothing to lose. And then you start doing these kind of metaphysical experiments, which were recommended by not just by the fundamentalists, but are also recommended by some of the most respected occultists that have ever existed, like Crowley. Crowley said, you know, try to contact every god. But once you've contacted each god, move on to the next one. You're done. You know, so contact Hahnemann. So
what is it? As soon as you get the call, hang up.
Yeah, and then call the next one.
Alan Watts said that, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, when you get the message, hang up the phone. But Crowley said, here's a phone book of gods. It's here's Krishna, Hanuman, Ganesh. Here's Satan. Here's Jesus. Here's a phone book of gods. It's called All the Scriptures of the World. Here's what you do. Make a phone call to every single one of them. And once you make contact with them, get the information you need, hang up the phone, and then call the next god. And keep doing it all the way down the line, because they're all just different pieces of this one, you know, magnificent, incredible happening. Because, you know, here we have the exterior universe with all its weight and beauty and power and all the things that scientists show us that fill us with such awe. But man, there is no denying the fact that we have a subjective universe that is teeming with all these potent mystical symbols. And why do some people take all these mystical symbols that exist in our minds, all those connections that happen the moment we tune into all of the myth and all the symbols in myth? There is a real beautiful thing that happens when you're a kid and you watch Star Wars for the first time, man. That is a mystical event. And when you see these archetypes playing out and you feel connected and you say, I am a fucking Jedi. I think I'm a Jedi, you know, that's real. It's just, but because it's existing in inner space instead of outer space, it gets reduced and negated by the materialists. And I don't see why. It's like the sparks and stars that exist in my mind are just as valid as the sparks and stars that exist outside of my mind. And if some of those sparks and stars are taking on the formation of mythological, deified creatures or beings, I don't see why I'm not allowed to connect to those things in the same way I'm allowed to connect to all the data coming from the external universe.
Brilliant.
Thanks.
Brilliant. Sorry, I'm getting my own little personal podcast here. I'm just listening like I'm...
I'm talking too much.
I listen to your show all the time, man, when I'm out walking my dog and stuff, and I just, you know, I get lost in your words, and I forget, like, I have to talk back to you.
No, scenario. never ask a stoner what he thinks God is. It's just the worst. I'm so sorry. I mean, I could just...
Nothing to apologize for, man. I love listening to you.
I love listening to you, man. I it really is, like... I I really do love, I like the different ways that people come to connect with the awe and I think all the ways are valid and beautiful and inspiring to me. It's any of them work. It's just like what, you know, it doesn't matter what gate you go into Disneyland through. It's like you're in, you know, you're in Disneyland.
Yeah.
Go through anyone that you want. And, you know, we got a little off track, but I'm glad we did. Cause I love talking about this stuff. It's I do want to get back into this movie that you're working on. I think people hear your passion and, I want to, how far along are you in your fundraising for this thing?
It hasn't been, I've managed to, talk to a lot of people all around the world and you were actually the last person on my initial wish list.
Ah,
so that's
cool.
That's an achievement unlocked right there.
Cool.
So, thank you for really, oh, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for having me on your show. This is amazing.
Let's do it again, man. But I want to, let's talk about how people can help out getting this story out into the world, because it's clearly a story that people need to hear about. This should be something that everyone just knows.
Great. Well, I'm crowdfunding right now at the minute on a new platform called Dana.io. Dana, as in the Buddhist term for giving without receiving. It's the world's first Buddhist crowdfunding platform. So if you're familiar with Kickstarter and Indiegogo, it's along those lines. And if you go to Dana.io/the Dharma Bum, you'll see our campaign page. I've got a pledge video there. It's very much like Kickstarter. So you got your pledge video and some details there and details of who I've got involved in the film, and you can buy t-shirts, you can actually be in the movie, because I'm this movie is going to be realized through animation, traditional hand-drawn 2D animation. So there's a certain pledge tier there that we can stick you in the movie as an animated character.
Cool.
I find a certain kind of poetry in the fact that we're bringing this lost legend back to life in an art form that is considered to be dying. So
That is really cool, man. And that is what you're doing. You know, it's like you one thing that's so exciting to me is like from time to time you hear about people saying, you know, we're going to bring the mammoth back. It's been frozen in the ice. But we think we have the technology now to bring these creatures back to the earth. And what you're doing is very similar. You're taking a story that has been frozen in the ice and you're thawing it out bringing it back to life. And that's a really cool thing, man. So I hope you guys listening will consider checking out that link. I'll have it at duncantrussell.com. Help get this movie made. And thank you so much, Ian, for taking the time to chat with me and for allowing me all of these rants that I just went on. You really clearly activated something inside of me. I really appreciate it.
Dude, I enjoyed and loved every second of it.
Beautiful. Okay, great. Well, thanks, man. And we will talk again soon.
Thank you very much, Duncan. I believe it's your birthday. Happy birthday to you.
Ah, brother. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Have a great day. And it's an honor that you would take the time out on your birthday to talk to nobody like myself.
Nah, bullshit. I can't think of a better birthday gift ever. I'm now officially having the greatest birthday I've ever had in my life. Thank you, Ian. I really appreciate it, man. And I'll talk to you soon.
Duncan.
Thanks for listening, everybody. That was Ian Lawton. I'm going to have links to his movie at duncantrussell.com in the comments section of this website. Thanks to harrys.com for supporting this episode of the DTFH. You can go to harrys.com, use offer code Duncan to get $5 off some sweet damn razor blades. And if you like this podcast, give us a nice rating on iTunes, won't you? And don't forget to use our Amazon portal, please, as a birthday gift to me. The next time you go swimming through the internet and plan on picking up something from Amazon, why not take a dip into the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Amazon portal? You can do it as easily as going to duncantrussell.com, clicking on the comments section of any of these podcasts, and clicking on the Amazon portal link. bookmark that thing, won't you? It's a great way to support this podcast, and it costs you not a penny. I hope you guys have a wonderful 420 and a wonderful rest of your week, a wonderful rest of your incarnation, and may every single cycle of time that the indestructible aspect of yourself that you truly are travels through be filled with bliss, multiple orgasms, and lots of sweet, sweet, deep French kissing, and good animals and pets and dogs. And you can even French kiss your dog. Nothing wrong with that. I love you. I'll talk to you next time. Hare Krishna. Now, please, I hope you will enjoy this track from the new, or one of the new Holy Sons albums. This is actually one of my favorite albums of all time. It's called Lost Decade 2. And you can buy the entire album by going to holysons.bandcamp.com. This track is called Young Man, and I want to dedicate it to all you sweeties out there who have been giving me birthday wishes today. I love you all, and I'll see you next time.
Well, I took a walk out to be in the sun with the dogs, and I took them out into the fields of wheat and stuff like that, or whatever the hell that shit is by the factory. And I wrote this song, and I don't know if it's sad or what, but it goes. And when the storm's clear, I'll be standing right here. I'll survive the sadness of this world. So let the sun rise. I am a young man. I'll live a long time. I hope my heart's not set on mine. I gotta move slow and let my eyes close, trust in this world with my life.
Did it originally.
You have got to be fucking kidding me, dude. You got to put that on my tape.